Welcome to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you so much for joining us on the program. We come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and p.m., Monday mornings at 1 a.m., and we stream live at richarddugan.com and newspress.com. We also archive these programs at richarddugan.com, the radio shows page, and we link to our guests. We'll give you the website in just a little bit, and we encourage you to check out our guests and the website and the information because I think it'll be very beneficial for you. And we will link to our guests' websites as well, just as we will today. And today is a very special program. Today is also a rather auspicious day, if you will, especially for the Irish, as I am Irish. And I wanted to do a program on this because I found out that today, the 24th of April in 1916, is referred to as Bloody Sunday. Well, we're going to get a definition and a lot of good information, but we're also going to focus on a film. And our guest in studio is going to talk to us about that. The film is called The Crooked Road. It's both a it is a musical and poetic review of Irish history leading up to Easter Rebellion, the Easter Rebellion of 1916. And in studio with me, and I'm very pleased to have him with us here on the program, is Dermot Johnson. And thank you so much for joining us.
Hello. Thanks very much, Richard.
And it's great having you in studio.
Well, it's nice to be here in Santa Barbara on this auspicious day, as you say, and privileged to be on your show as well.
And I have to say that this day is one in which a lot of folks look back on, obviously the Irish in particular, because it was a very sad day. And this was right around the time of World War I starting up and all of that. But the Irish have had in their history a lot of struggles with different civilizations coming in. And this, obviously, in 1916 was dealing primarily, if I'm understanding correctly, with the British. I'm not as much as I love Ireland and would like to, of course, live there one day. I don't have all of the information. I'm learning as I'm going. I'm trying to get more educated. But you have produced, if you will, a movie called The Crooked Road. Let's start there. Tell us a little bit about this film, and also how people can how they can watch it.
Well, The Crooked Road is a it's an idea taking the Irish history and culture and going right back to the beginnings and telling this story, but not in a way that historians usually do, maybe, which is often very chronological and has its own methodology. So I do it in a creative way. I take pieces of music where I can find them that have to do with the different periods in question. Or if we go back very far, there is no music. So I take pieces of maybe literature, a poem, something from an old manuscript in Gaelic. And some of this I've translated, and so I take these elements, put them together to form a narrative or to form a show, and call it The Crooked Road because it turns left and it turns right, and it looks at some details, probably overlooks certain important events because we can't portray 2,000 years in an hour and a half or in 2 hours, you know. So it's a personal reaction to the history of Ireland since the earliest times.
I know that the history is obviously, it is indeed spotted with a great deal of conflict with other civilizations, but it is also canvassed, if you will, with a great deal of community of love and joy and family and so forth. The Irish have a very rich culture, as many do. Can we maybe start with maybe some of the Celtic information or the historical aspects? And again, I acknowledge the fact that you're not an historian per se, but you have gathered this information, and it is all very intriguing to myself and others, and I hope that our listeners are intrigued as well. So share with us a little bit of the if you will, the Celtic, which expands beyond Ireland, certainly, but it's certainly influenced the Irish culture.
Well, Irish culture, as we call it. Now, what do we mean by Irish? That's the first
question.
That's
a good question.
You see? So if we think of Irish, well, to that I would add the word Gaelic, Gaelic. Okay. So Irish culture as we know it, being Anglophone or English speaking, and being related to a certain number of recognised symbols and ideas and so on, this is actually quite a recent form of culture. And it's a form of culture which evolved after the Great Famine in the mid-19th century. But Gaelic culture is something else, in fact, not completely distinct. But the fact that the English language... So can you imagine that the 20th century is the first century in history when the English language was the majority language in Ireland? Now, the 20th century was the first century in history when the English language was the majority language in many places, Ireland included.
Mm-hmm.
So what were people speaking before the 20th century?
Yeah.
Well, in Ireland, people were speaking Gaelic. That's not to say there was no English in Ireland before 1900. There was. And especially in the wake of the famine, a linguistic change happened. But Irish Gaelic was the majority language, the language of the people, of millions of people in Ireland all throughout history. So what does this language tell us? Well, this language is still spoken in Ireland. It's spoken residually in what we call the Gaeltacht. The Gaeltacht is what's left of traditional Irish-speaking areas. And these areas are small areas in the west of the country, on the western seaboard, where the people still speak their own language and have always done so. By now, they're bilingual.
Mm-hmm.
Almost everybody speaks English in Ireland. 98% of the people. The only ones who don't speak English are the little kids before they go to school.
Right.
Some of them learn Irish at home and only learn English a little later when they're 4 or 5 years old. But the population is bilingual. But this Gaelic was the only language known to the vast majority of people in Ireland before the famine. So that what was being said in English or in French or in any other language was foreign to them and inaccessible, actually.
Is Gaelic today, the 21st century, is it still considered the national language, or is English now the national language of Ireland?
Well, in the Constitution... we have two official languages. And officially, Irish is the first of those. And the state also acknowledges English as being a national language. In practical terms, it's the opposite. It's the other way around. English is the language of Ireland now.
Right.
Irish is the traditional language, which has been replaced over time, but which today... is still vibrant, albeit spoken as a second language by most people now.
Is it still taught?
Yes, Irish is still taught in the schools. Most children have access to classes either where they learn Irish, or there are schools where the lessons are delivered through the medium of Irish.
Why is it important to learn Gaelic?
Well, that's a personal thing in a way. I think it's probably important for people to have the choice, have the choice. Now, for us today, talking about history and how things developed over the centuries, the point I'd make is that without an understanding of Gaelic, an appreciation of it, without recourse to it, without the ability to read it, in fact, before the mid-19th century... And to some extent since that, the whole history of Ireland is inaccessible. It's inaccessible because it's documented through Gaelic. It's documented in the Gaelic language.
And if you can't read Gaelic...
We can't read the history. Now, to read Gaelic, medieval Gaelic, early modern Gaelic and so on, this is an academic pursuit. You need to be trained to do that. The language has changed over time. And so on. But without that ability, without an educational system which trains people to be literate in Irish and to have the possibility to go forward and learn to read Irish as it was written in the 18th century or the 17th or the 12th century, without this, over 1,000 years of history is lost to us, in fact.
And what is, from your understanding, what is the origin of Gaelic? How far back does it go, and where does it come from? What, because nothing is created in a vacuum, so it was obviously created from other languages. But I'll be honest with you, I've listened to it, I've tried to learn it, and I can't pin it down, you know, as far as some other nation or culture or what have you.
Well, we can go right back to the beginning, and if we do that, we talk first about the Indo-European languages. Now, the Indo-European language is a vast family of languages. Sanskrit in India, Latin and Greek in Europe, and then many other languages. And they're divided into families. So in Europe, the major families of languages are Germanic, Slavic, Romance, and Celtic. Germanic includes English, German, Icelandic, Norwegian, and so on. Romance includes Italian, Spanish, Romanian. Slavic includes Polish, Russian, mm-hmm. and so on and so on. Celtic includes Irish, or better technically, Gaelic. We mm-hmm. call it Gaelic. Also related to the Irish language, itself a Celtic language, we have Welsh mm-hmm. and Breton. And these are the Celtic languages. They're a family. They're one of the families of the, they're a branch of the vast Indo-European family. And these languages, the Celtic languages, were spoken in Europe, on mainland Europe, the continent of Europe, before classical times, before the rise of the Roman Empire. So Rome built a vast empire, and Latin became the language of administration over Europe, down into northern Africa and so on. And before that time, the Celtic languages were spoken in Europe. They were spoken in present-day France, the Gaulish language. They were spoken further east. And these, the people speaking these languages emigrated or migrated to the islands, to Britain and to Ireland. And this is where a modern form of these old languages has survived.
And to the people, I have heard it said that there is speculation. I don't know if there's real evidence to this effect, to this fact, that the Irish people may actually be one of the 13 tribes. Is there any truth, as far as you know, to that, or is that more mythology than fact?
Well, there's probably no basis to that. The point is that over time, the Gaelic people, they wrote their own history sometime about the 12th century, and it was put in a book called Leabhar Gaoála Éireann, the Book of Invasions, it's called. And this was a fabricated history.
Mm-hmm.
And the Gaelic people, when they came to Ireland, found there other inhabitants from Bronze Age times and so on. And these people, in their turn, were conquered. And so the Gaelic people in the Middle Ages, medieval times, they fabricated a history to give themselves credence.
Hmm.
So it may be that they came from the 13 tribes of Israel. That means that they have credence. It may be that they came from royal Spanish origin. That gives them credence. So this is a fabricated history from medieval times by which the Gael or the Gaelic people established their dominance in the island of Ireland, where before they came, other populations were already living.
And just for clarification, what, in your opinion, is the difference between Celtic and Gaelic? I know that there obviously there's an interconnectedness, but are the Irish Gaelic and Celtic? In other words, the transition.
Well, that's a very good question. It's simple enough to answer. Think of Celtic as a set, mm-hmm. and Gaelic as a member of this set. Ah. It's like being Californian and American.
Okay.
Okay. It's like being both.
Mm-hmm.
So the Irish people are Irish or Gaelic and Celtic.
And then, of course, as you mentioned, there's the Scots, the Welsh, the Brits, and so forth. And they're all they're also Celtic.
That's right. So the Welsh can say that they are Welsh speakers. They're speakers of a Welsh language. Therefore, that they are Celtic in a linguistic way.
Mm-hmm.
So we have a set, a broad set, and members of that set. So the Gaelic is specific, and Celtic is generic.
Now, folks are probably wondering, why are we going back so far in this context to talk about this in reference to The Crooked Road, which is the film regarding the Easter Rebellion, or I guess they refer to it as Bloody Sunday. Am I using the right term, or is that a different day?
We usually speak of the Easter Rising.
Easter Rising.
The Easter Rising is what is how we refer to events of the 24th of April 1916 in Dublin.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that we're going through this process is because I also want to talk a little bit about the various cultures that came to Ireland, and also some of the, and that I have been corrected in some of the knowledge that I had gained regarding Ireland and its landscape, and the fact that the reason why there are so few trees in Ireland, or have been for so many years, is because the conquerors would come in and they would cut down all the wood and build all these ships, and now all this wood is at the bottom of the ocean. And I was supposedly misinformed about that particular fact. At least I that's what I've been told. And this is another problem. I remember the 500th anniversary of Christopher Columbus, for example. I had three different versions of the history of Chris Columbus. I don't know which one to believe, or if it's a compilation of the three. He was an angel, he was somewhere in the middle, and he was also a devil. Okay, well, humanity is kind of that way. We have our good and our bad days. So what about this whole aspect of these various civilizations coming to the Irish Isle, and for whatever reasons, wanting to, it's kind of like, what, did the Irish have a sign up say, come and conquer us, or something like this? That seems to be the nomenclature, that it's like every time you turned around, somebody was, hey, we're gonna take these people.
Well, what was happening in Ireland often reflects things that were happening in a broader context. So, for example, the Vikings were a people from southern Scandinavia.
Mm-hmm.
So, in about the year 800, for diverse reasons, demography, growth in population, or maybe for political reasons, dissent, conflict, the Vikings started to travel forth from their native place and travel further and stay longer in the places they reached. And they went east, they went west, Greenland, they came as far as the coast of Newfoundland, and they also came to Ireland. They didn't come in huge numbers, but they settled in the east,
mm-hmm.
and founded some of the towns like Wexford and Waterford. So the Vikings came to Ireland, but they that was part of a larger expansion. They went east to St. Petersburg in Russia. They went as far as the Mediterranean, the Azores, on the Spanish coast.
Oh, yes, uh-huh.
Yeah. So the next major, I don't know if it's an invasion, but it's definitely an encroachment,
mm-hmm.
were the Normans. And who were they? The Normans came from northern France, and they started to expand in the 11th century. And they also expanded in different directions. At this time, the Crusades were taking place in Europe. The Crusaders were going to Jerusalem to try to reclaim Jerusalem from the so-called infidel.
Mm-hmm.
And a military culture then brought them over the Channel to Britain. And there was a battle in Hastings in 1066 when the Normans were victorious, conquered England, and from there they made their way to Ireland and built their castles. And these castles you can see in different places,
mm-hmm.
in Ireland, also in Wales, on the continent, and as far as the Middle East today. So again, the context is quite broad. What was happening in Ireland was typical, in a way, of expansions that were happening at the time.
Do the Irish have in their history a propensity at any time for any kind of expansion or
evidence that in
I was just thinking that. I was just, they have a drink and fight amongst themselves. Yes, exactly.
Time when the Irish and go abroad word to other places. And this is one example of Irish influence abroad. We can put it that way. So St. Brendan in the 6th century sailed from a place in County Kerry and spent 7 years with a group of monks on the ocean, and saw an iceberg and landed on a whale, and landed somewhere which may in fact have been the coast of Northern America.
Hmm. So Columbus wasn't necessarily the first one to set foot here.
No, Columbus definitely wasn't.
I still struggle with that whole historical aspect because it's like, okay, if Columbus discovered America, the continent of America, then why is it named America after Amerigo Vespucci? I've never been able to find that connection, but that's sort of a neither here nor there. Now, in terms of the name for Ireland, the Emerald Isle is pretty self-explanatory because it's all green. I used to joke with some of the people on a program I produce called the Golf Radio Program that, I don't need to go to a golf course here. I just go to Ireland and play the country, you know. but where did the name come from?
Oh, that's a difficult question. I'll try and answer it. So the name in Gaelic for Ireland is Éire. Éire. The English word Ireland is a derivation from that.
Mm-hmm.
And Éire is one of the ancient names of Ireland, and there were several. So in the mythology, we find Éire, we find Fola, and we find Banava. There are actually three, if not more.
Mm-hmm.
It's also called Inish Fáil. So it's called several things in Gaelic mythology. And Éire is the one which gained preference. And it did so quite early. The Romans called it Hibernia. Now, you might ask me where the name Éire came from, being Gaelic or not. That question brings us even further back into history and prehistory. And I don't know if we really want to go there today.
No, we want to kind of move forward. But I will say to kind of bring that one to round of the circle, that there are a couple of sites that my wife and I had a privilege of visiting when we were in Ireland. One of them was the prehistoric mound in considered northeastern Ireland, Newgrange. And we had, in my opinion, we had the great privilege of descending into the chamber. Now, it wasn't on the auspicious day of December 21st at sunrise, but it didn't matter. And as a man of sound, I found the interior sound quality to be just pristine. It was extraordinary. I also love the fact that they will not allow you to record in any form on the interior, and if I remember, kind of sort of out of respect for the ancestors, if you will. Another place, now you go to the west off of Galway, the Aran Islands, and we went to Inishmore and the prehistoric fort, I guess it is, granite fort. And I guess you're familiar with that giant slab that sits out and hangs out over the
That's
edge?
Right.
I sat on the edge of that, taking pictures.
You're a brave man.
At the time, I was. But when we got back to the island Inishmore, where we were staying, or I'm sorry, Inishnee, there in Galway, just off of Roundstone, I was safe and snug and warm in that stone cottage there and scared out of my mind, not realizing how dangerous what I had just done was.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was spectacular. And so we find these different sites across Ireland, as well as the castles, which are certainly newer by comparison. But we see that they had that fort there on that island to the west, facing the North Atlantic.
Well, that it's called Dún Éingus, and it's a bit of an enigma, really.
Yeah.
And so it seems possible that these places were built, these sites are pre-Gaelic, in mm-hmm. fact, so they belong to cultures which have become extinct.
Yeah.
And perhaps it was their last refuge as they fled from the Gael and from the Irish people, whether they were Neolithic people, as was probably the case, or Bronze Age people. On the other hand, what we say sometimes is that, well, perhaps the climate was different then, and that these places which are today hostile and cold and windy, that perhaps at the time they were more like the Californian Riviera, you see.
It could
but
have been,
we've
yeah.
had climate change in the meantime.
Although I do enjoy the cold and windy. We were, a matter of fact, visiting a stone circle down in southern Ireland west of Cork, and we got out and we started taking pictures, and the wind and the rain, and actually it wasn't a hard rain, it was more of a mist, and that's one of the things I noticed was the rain was not nearly the, it didn't have the harshness as it was coming down, but we both were just freezing, but loving it, just absolutely having the greatest time. I says we were just baptized, but it wasn't by fire, it was by ice.
And well, we call it when it rains like that, the soft rain. We say it's a soft day. Mm. It's a soft day.
Oh, and just being in the country is wonderful. So to bring it forward in terms of the historical context that we've painted to some degree on a very small canvas, how has the history of the Irish if I can put it in this context, created or built up to this spot in history that we know of, as you've referred to, as the Easter Rising of April 24th of 1916?
Well, I suppose we can look directly to the 17th century. In 1603, there was a battle in Kinsale between Gaelic clansmen and the professional English army of Queen Elizabeth, and it became apparent that there was no further resistance in Ireland to a professional organised army, and the Irish leaders capitulated. Soon after that they left the country. 99 members of the Irish or Gaelic aristocracy in 1607 sailed on a boat from Lough Foley. The country was in distress. The common people were subjected to unjust and brutal laws under the British Crown. And this was the state of affairs until the late 18th century. And then from about 1770 to 1803, a lot of things start to happen. Well, it was happening here with the War of Independence, the French Revolution, and as part of that are inspired by these things, the United Irishmen, hoping for backup and support from the continent, organised a revolution in 1798. This was put down, suppressed, and it led to the Act of Union in 1803, whereby the Parliament in Dublin was dissolved, so that Ireland was under direct rule from London. And the history of 1916 begins then, the hope and ambition being to re-establish a parliament in Ireland and to gain political independence from London. Mm. So during the 19th century, there are various attempts. You've heard of the Fenians and so on. In the 20th century, what was happening was that, in fact, the whole geopolitical landscape of Europe and further afield was changing. This is what the First World War was about. Three empires were unravelling, you might say. You had the Ottoman Empire of the Turks, which for five centuries had been hugely influential in the East. You had the Austro-Hungarian Empire in Vienna, and Budapest, which for two or three centuries had governed most of southwestern Europe. And you had the British Empire, which at that time was beginning to crack. Mm. In the 20th century, many countries emerged from the shadow of the British Empire, whether it be India and so on, to name but one, and Ireland too was going to emerge from the shadow of the British Empire. The question was how?
Yeah.
And the way it began, the catalyst, was unexpected. And this is 1916. And I sometimes think, what would have happened if there had been no uprising? The question is, how would Ireland have emerged? And it probably would. So today, Scotland seems to be emerging from imperial times. Mm-hmm. Perhaps Scotland will be an independent, sovereign country in our lifetime. It's taken longer there. So this is the context of 1916. The strategy was clear. All eyes were on Europe. France and Germany were warring in the trenches. The British army was engaged. All its resources were being poured into Europe. So a small group of optimistic idealists, very diverse, they decided to stage this rising. And they did.
I'd heard, and I hope I have the right event correct as far as this information is concerned, but I had heard that had the Irish known that they outnumbered the British in that rising, that it would have been different. The ending would have been a whole lot different than it was. Is that correct? That the Irish actually did outnumber the soldiers?
I'm not quite sure.
Yeah.
I'm sure the British had reserves that the Irish didn't. One of the things which characterizes any military operation, this rising included, is communication.
Mm-hmm.
And so the channels of communication between different cells of insurgents were poor. Mm-hmm. The channels were poor. So on one hand, you have the potential for action. On the other hand, you have the limited resources. And so in this case, the resources weren't used to their full. There were other units around the country who failed to rise, who decided not to, who didn't know until it was over, and so on.
Yeah.
Whereas the British Army, whether they were outnumbered or not, they would have been able to use their resources to the full.
There's also, in reference to this film that we're also talking about and referencing, The Crooked Road, there's also what's referred to as a lively piece of music that goes along with this, called The Crooked Road. You are also, it's not a flute, it's actually a tin whistle. Is that correct?
Well, I have a tin whistle here.
Yes.
I do. I have a flute as well.
And you have a flute as well. And I'm wondering if when we come back, if maybe we might be... I would assume you know that song.
I do. I can remember it as well.
Okay. When we come back, we're going to... I'd love to hear it. I know our listeners would too. And we're talking with Dermot Johnson, and we're talking about the anniversary of the Easter Rising April 24th, 1916, as here we are on April 24th, 2016, and 100 years later. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. Stay tuned. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. Thank you for staying with us here on the program. We're talking with Dermot Johnson, and Dermot Johnson is here in Santa Barbara, and he's addressing a group of people throughout his stay, talking about a wide variety of different things. And I'm so thankful that you were able to spend some time here in studio with us. We're talking about a film called The Crooked Road, which chronicles the events of 100 years ago this day, called The Easter Rising. It's called The Crooked Road, and there's also a piece of music that goes along with that. And I'm wondering if you could maybe give us a little bit of the maybe the background of this particular piece.
This is a piece of music called The Crooked Road to Dublin originally. It's a reel. A reel is a form of dance music in Ireland. Very, very popular amongst traditional musicians. And so you can imagine the people 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and making their way from the country to Dublin to look for work, or maybe to get on an emigration ship. And one of the fabulous things about the Irish and their culture is the great spirit, which you'll find in the music. And despite life being hard, that there's always time for a song and a dance.
You know, and I even met a young man from Northern Ireland, and we were chatting about it, and, you know, I was sharing my affinities and so forth, and he says, well, what is the one thing that you like so much about Ireland that makes you want to live there? And of course, he already knew the answer to my question, and I says, it's the people. I said, I cannot recall ever experiencing that kind of acceptance and embracing. I mean, even we were in so many different pubs while we were there. It was just extraordinary. And so, yeah, it's that whole aspect of one of the things I think that we sort of lose here in the United States is that whole aspect of community. It's starting to come back, and it has always been in many pockets, little pockets. And so I'm excited about the resurgence, if you will, of that whole concept. But Ireland has always had that.
Very warm.
And they've always looked out for one another. As a matter of fact, I have a dear friend who, she and her husband moved up to San Francisco, and she has told me and my wife many times, if you ever need a place to stay in Ireland, you can stay with my father. You know, and it's like, you know what? I don't even care if we had transportation. If we flew in and he picked us up and we just, I would walk everywhere. It's not that big of an island. Come on, you know. it'd be a wonderful place. But I'd love to, if you would, share with us a little bit of this piece called The Crooked Road.
Well, I can play it for you now. It's very short.
Okay.
I might play it twice.
All right. Thank you very much. I appreciate that. You are an accomplished musician in this regard. You obviously play a numerous instruments, wind as well as, and I'm probably going to mispronounce the drum, the baron.
The baron, yeah.
The baron.
I concentrate on the wind instrument. So mm-hmm. I play the whistle.
Mm-hmm.
I love to play the whistle. And I play the wooden flute as well. That's probably my main instrument.
Is that your main because it's your favorite?
I think so.
The
yeah.
sound?
I think so. The sound of the wooden flute is very warm and mm-hmm. rich, and I tend to play every day.
I'd love to hear a little bit from the flute.
Well, here's the flute. It's a hardwood flute, black. Originally, it's a Baroque model, which was developed in England and Germany in the 18th and 19th centuries, and it became part of the Irish traditional arsenal, if you like,
mm-hmm.
About 100, 150 years ago, maybe. And I'll play you a little tune now on this flute.
Blah, 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 Beautiful. Thank you. I have to say that music is can be found probably in most cultures, and it's a very important aspect. One of the other aspects, too, that when we were talking about the Gaelic language, for example, and it made me think about the different ways in which the Irish communicated under different circumstances. And I'd love for you to elaborate on the Irish dance, or dances, if you will, and how they were used to communicate when the Irish were prohibited by their rulers or overseers, if you will, from passing on either messages or the Irish culture or the Irish religion, the Celtic religion, et cetera, et cetera. So they figured, okay, we'll just put it in the dance. And they couldn't raise their hands, which is the reason why they didn't. Why, when we see river dance and those kinds of things, and they're dancing around with their hands down by their sides, but it was communicated through the dance.
Well, it was communicated through one of the little stories I've just remembered hearing your question and so on, is that the tunes have names. And so one of the tunes was called The First House in Connacht. The First House in Connacht. And this was a Cayley house. And people would congregate there to sing and dance and to exchange information and so on. Also during times of oppression and times of prospective rebellion. So by saying, if I said to you now, if I said, well, we're going to meet, actually, I wouldn't even tell you, I wouldn't even say we're going to meet next week in the first house in Connacht, but I would whistle you the beginning of the tune. I would whistle you the first two bars of the tune. I would go, and you would recognize the tune, and you now know where we're going to meet.
Mm. Yeah, and the others never picked up on it.
Oh, this was far too subtle, yeah. Far too subtle indeed.
It was like hiding a code in plain sight, if you will.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Very interesting, and it. That's one of the, shall we say, ingenious qualities of the Irish in that regard, was that they were able to do that and continue on as they have to this day.
And to do so with a good deal of humor,
yeah,
as well.
And I find that as we go through our daily lives in whatever country and from whatever nationality we come from, if we can't go through the challenges and the struggles with some kind of humor, I try to put it into a bigger perspective, saying that, you know, in the big picture, this is really unimportant. This doesn't really make any difference whatsoever, you know. I just find that so fascinating. I remember when we were traveling around, and I, of course, had at first struggled with, for example, the signs, the street signs, which were both in English and Gaelic. And it took me a while to figure out which was which sometimes because I didn't know the towns. We've actually went to Wexford on one journey and stopped along the way and stopped in some of the shops. And again, it was always the people. But my wife had this interesting affinity for cemeteries. And at first, when we first made a couple of stops, I thought, that's kind of more me. And I actually, positive perspective, are the ones that created the towns that they're in. And if it weren't for those people lying there in the ground, this town wouldn't exist and these people wouldn't be here and this civilization wouldn't continue on.
Well, that's right. Well, we have different ways of honoring the dead, you know, and It's not a particularly morbid thing. It's a form of respect.
Yeah.
And it's also a form of self-respect, because by respecting our elders and ancestors, we're respecting what we learned from them.
Yeah. And I noticed, too, that I don't think there was a single cemetery that didn't have very ornate headstones and statuary and all of this. I mean, it was, you know, nothing was low to the ground. And one of the things that I noticed too, especially around a lot of the churches, especially the old churches that were no longer being used, obviously, for services, the roofs were gone and so forth. I noticed that many people were entombed in the walls and in the floors inside the church walls. Do you know what the tradition there was? What was that about? Why would they? Obviously, these had to be significant people in the community to be honored in that fashion.
Well, it's a question of consecrated space. So the consecrated space begins around the altar and takes up all the space within the walls of the church.
Mm-hmm.
The cemetery is often an extension. So you're in the shadow of the walls of the church, or you're within a wall which makes of the cemetery part of the consecrated space of the church.
Mm.
But in earlier times, and particularly perhaps in the case of dignitaries, the holiest place to be buried was at the center of the consecrated space, and so within the church walls.
Mm.
And so in medieval times, you'll find the sepulchres or graves of bishops and noblemen under the roof of the church.
Hmm. I will share with you briefly a little story. When my wife and I were there in 2004, we were there for her birthday in February, and we went to, of course, the Bridget's Well in Kildare. But we took a ferry to the Aran Islands to Inishmore, and the night before, I'd had a dream, but it was not a visual dream. It was auditory. It was of a friend of ours who had passed in our home back in Phoenix. And his voice was loud and clear saying, "Don't say anything bad in front of Bridget." I didn't think anything of it, but I had shared it. So there we are, and we're walking through the ruins, if you will, of the seven churches on Inishmore. And I was over at one of these altars taking pictures of what I jokingly said was the first wheel. And my wife comes over and says, "You need to come over here." And I said, "Okay." So I walked over to this tombstone that was flat to the ground. She says, "You need to read the stone." So I read the stone. Now, my wife's maiden name is McDonough. McDonough. And the name on the tombstone was Bridget. And I literally put my hand over my mouth, and I walked away because I didn't want to risk saying anything bad around Bridget. The experiences that we had there, could be considered maybe mystical, spiritual, or fairy-like, because when we were at Bridget's Well, I took some photographs, digital photographs, and I have zoomed in tight. It's not a leaf, and people will look at it and say it's a fairy, and so forth. Tell me a little bit about that part of the history of Ireland, and how that, if there's a source for how that started or where that came from.
Well, I remember a student of mine some years ago, where I was teaching, a young girl about 18, came to the first year class, and she was introducing herself, and one of the first things she said to me was, "Do you believe in the fairies?" she asked me. And this was her way of finding out what sort of a professor I was, you see?
Mm. Do you believe? Are you a believer, if you will?
So I said whatever I said. But the this part of the culture is still present in Ireland.
Mm-hmm.
And for me, it makes perfect sense in its own way. The difference between it and modern culture is that it's not abstract, and that it's not, it doesn't seek to be entirely rational or empirical. So belief in these sort of things is a way of externalizing some of our own anxieties, some of our own fears, some of our own doubts about ourselves and about the world. But rather than doing this in a scientific way, as psychologists might do today, or in a behavioral way, we do it by giving them concrete value. So we call the unknown something concrete.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how it works. And by doing so, you externalize the doubt within, make it something concrete, and in this way create a way of dealing with it. And that, for me, that is the way, that is how I see the these traditional cultures. And I find it very helpful, actually.
Well, anything that we can use to help us get through the day is certainly a benefit. I remember when I was working for a religious station back in Phoenix, and I used to hear all kinds of comments, negative comments about Catholicism and the statuary, the idolatry, the icons and so forth. And I said, well, you know, they're not actually praying to them, and they don't look at them as gods. They're looking at for help. They're looking for guidance. They're looking for encouragement and support. And if it helps them, what's wrong with that? You know, I've always been intrigued by these stories, these different stories. And that's kind of what makes up our lives. I mean, certainly history is a series of stories that retells the events that actually happen. But then there's what we could label as, then there's the mythology. And when we did our mythological series back in 2014 here on this program called Mythosophia, Exploring the Depths of Myth and Wisdom, we barely touched upon the Irish or Celtic or Gaelic, if you will, mythology from that part of the world. But it's everywhere. Every culture has its mythology and its, if you will, its gods or its hierarchy or what have you. And I think that it's there to teach us in a big way.
The Gaelic mythology is contained in three tales in a book called The Book of the Dun Cow, because it was written on the skin of a cow. And this book is in medieval Gaelic, and there are at least three mythological tales in this book. There's no creation myth in Gaelic culture.
No.
Or in Celtic culture. We don't find an explanation of how the world was created.
We're just here.
We are just here. Mm. And it seems like we're always going to be here because there's no eschatology or prophecy regarding the end of the world.
Yeah.
So what we have is life taking different forms as time passes, and there are three major tales in this book. One is called the Wooing of Ymir or Evid, and she undergoes two reincarnations, is married to a mortal king, has a lover from the other world, and we find this story in the book. Another is called the Battle of Moytura, which tells about the Gaelic gods, the Tuatha Dé Danann, and their struggle with the Fomorians. And it may be an analogy for invasion, native gods being ousted by the gods of the invader.
Mm.
And even here we find humour. The supreme god of the Tuatha Dé Danann is called the Daida, and he's captured and he's made to eat porridge until his belly is almost bursting. But he's saved at the end of the day, partly because of the magic of Lu of the Long Hand, the god of sun and lightning.
Mm.
And there's another story called about a pagan king called Conaire, who's a benign and benevolent king, and under whom there's peace and prosperity. But his destiny, he cannot escape, and he's destined to err and to lose his kingdom and ultimately his life.
Mm.
And these stories we find in medieval Gaelic.
Let me ask you a little bit about more of the mysticism, the spiritual aspects of the Irish Gaelic Celtic culture, if you will. One term comes to mind, Anamkara. I had the opportunity of interviewing a gentleman in Ireland on the phone in regards to this. Tell us a little bit about what does that mean and what is it?
The answer is very simple. The English word is confessor. So if you go to confess your sins to the priest is your confessor. And in medieval Gaelic tradition, this is the Anam Chara. The Anam is the soul and Chara is friend. It's related to the word charity in English, or caritas in Latin. So it's friend of the soul. And that's the medieval Gaelic for confessor.
Okay. You are also a poet, and you have a book of poetry, and I would love for you to share with us a selection of your choosing, obviously, to share with us before we're running close to the end of the program, but we're not done yet. And I'd love for you to share with us a piece from the work. And I'm curious, before you do, what does poetry not just mean to you, but how does it affect you, especially when you write it?
Well, poetry is a strange thing. It's not something you can put anywhere or compare to anything. So you have to go straight to it and try and catch it. There's an Irish poet called Sean O'Riordan, and his image for describing poetry was the robin's tail. Is that you can see the bird, observe it, and it'll fly away of its own accord. If you try to catch its tail or to imprison it, in fact, you will take its soul away and kill it. So we observe the bird coming and going, the inspiration coming and going, and it makes us aware of things that are happening around us. So for me, by eliminating the ambient noise, and not just the sonoric noise, but the noise of superfluous thoughts that we have in our heads all the time, is you can ultimately hear the world breathing. And this is what poetry is.
What do you have to share with us this program?
Well, as we say at home, do you want a sad one or a happy one?
I'll take the sad one, believe it or not.
That's good.
And then we'll go to the happy one.
That's good. Well, one of the abiding things about the famine in Ireland is the lack of commentary on it. Perhaps the trauma was too great. And when the trauma is great, the soul seems to recede into silence. I had to experience the crooked road. I thought about a tragedy on this scale. Can it be written? And I wrote a few lines about the famine, if you'd like to hear them. Famine. Her eyes were blue as a horse's blood, 3 miles before dawn on the mountain. All memory of light had grown faint. God's name was empty as a field in winter. Her eyes were blue as a horse's blood, 2 miles before dawn on the mountain. A stillborn child she bore by the well. In her shawl its bones she buried. Her eyes were blue as a horse's blood, 1 mile before dawn on the mountain. 100 feverish nights away, a cup of buttermilk is waiting.
I'm seeing the images as you're reading, and very, very interesting. Do we have one more before we have to close?
Well, I wrote a little tongue-in-cheek piece about St. Patrick.
I have one quick question. According to what I've seen on some programs regarding the geography of Ireland, there were never actually any snakes on the island. And so when people ask me about that, I say, no, the snake was a metaphor. That's what it was, because there were no actual snakes. Is that true?
You know, you're exactly right. And whether or not there were snakes, the point is that it is a metaphor or an allegory.
Yeah.
And that somebody at the time knew about snakes, and that the allegory worked.
Indeed it did. So share with
us. Well, I'll read you some of these lines about, it's called The Ballad of St. Patrick. And, they're very facetious, you know, but we can't dwell on tragedy all the time. And have you heard of Ryanair?
It's
a low-cost
airline. Yeah.
Airline, yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I've flown on it.
Have you?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, then you know exactly what I mean. So I'm going to read you a few verses of this, not the whole poem. St. Patrick was a Fenian's son, but loathed the gun and preached discretion. No need to start a war, he said. Come down to Galway. We'll have a session. He never flew with Ryanair. A saint, he wore a vacant stare. The angels spoke to him at night. He read James Joyce. with great delight. St. Patrick never nurtured strife, nor took a wife, or marijuana. But Irish stew he did devour, it gave him power to cry, Hosanna!
Very, very nicely done. I want to thank you so much for joining us on the program, Dermot, and it's been a pleasure to have you in studio and here in Santa Barbara, and I hope that one day we can get together again and talk further on these very what I consider to be very important and on very fun topics as well. And to that end, I say to you before we wrap up, Slancha. My wife and I, every time we depart, it's always either I love you and or slangafal.
Slangafal agus gur míle maith go hain.
Before we let you go, three final questions. Who is Dermot Johnson?
He's the man sitting in front of you at this minute.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Pass.
Okay, I'll accept that. And finally, who inspires you?
The people who inspire me are people who have a vision and who dedicate their lives to that vision.
Mm. I want to let our listeners know that the entire interview is available at richarddugan.com, the radio show's page. And is there a particular website that we want to send people to?
Some of my work you can see on www.dermotjohnson.net.
And we will have a link to that on our website. We encourage you to check that out. And again, Dermot, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much indeed. All the best to everybody here in Santa Barbara.
I'm Richard Dugan. This has been Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World, giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. Until next time, love to Lal.
Now we walk the crooked road to seek out the saints of old, cold as cod, who plough their foaming furrow with feather and with ink and light their candles in the way. We walk the crooked road to an island where eyes like an axe, mean as an eel, the salty leather-lipped Vikings spill ashore to burn green rushy roofs in the land of the Milky Monk. The crooked road where salmon run and flash in the bog-red river, and black sails round the headland. Salt gales thunder there, and the seaweed houses sing of sleep, an inch from Atlantic seagull deep. My name is Dermot Johnson, and I'd like you to join me on The Crooked Road, a ramble through Irish history in word, image and music. The new show will be on the road soon in Europe and the United States. It tells the story of Ireland and its people, from a time of myth to the coming of the Christian saints, from the Vikings and Normans to the rise of English rule. The Crooked Road opens doors on the rich and varied past that Ireland has inherited and culminates with the Easter Rising of 1916, when a handful of courageous idealists challenged the might of an empire. Poverty and emigration mark this history, but pride and determination shine through to create a modern, independent nation. Join me for a ramble along the crooked road. Ishkin a haun, kor agus kwitte, mean it is lekker.
cuinach chuas na mlíon. Siamann seo cos éasa a dianam a chuid smuinti. Siamann seo cos linne a fanach le brodán a níntas.